Before I could plot a logical course through the icefall, the wind came up, and snow began to slant hard out of the clouds, stinging my face and reducing visibility to almost nothing. For the better part of the day, I groped blindly through the labyrinth in the whiteout, retracing my steps from one dead end to another. Time after time, I'd think I'd found a way out, only to wind up in a deep blue cul-de-sac or stranded atop a detached pillar of ice. My efforts were lent a sense of urgency by the noises emanating from beneath my feet, a madrigal of creaks and sharp reports, the sort of protest a large fir limb makes when it's slowly bent to the breaking point, served as a reminder that it is the nature of glaciers to move, the habit of seracs to topple. I put a foot through a snow bridge spanning a slot so deep I couldn't see the bottom of it. A little later, I broke through another bridge to my waist. The poles kept me out of the 100-foot crevasse, but after I extricated myself, I bent double with dry heaves, thinking about what it would be like to be lying in a pile at the bottom of the crevasse, waiting for death to come, with nobody aware of how or where I'd met my end. Night had nearly fallen by the time I emerged from the top of the serac slope onto the empty, wind-scoured expanse of the high glacial plateau. In shock and chilled to the core, I skied far enough past the icefall to put its rumblings out of earshot, pitched the tent, crawled into my sleeping bag, and shivered myself into a fitful sleep. I had planned on spending between 3 weeks and a month on the Stikine ice cap. Not relishing the prospect of carrying a 4-week load of food, heavy winter camping gear, and climbing hardware all the way up the Baird on my back, I had paid a bush pilot in Petersburg $150, the last of my cash, to have 6 cardboard cartons of supplies dropped from an airplane when I reached the foot of the thumb. On his map, I'd showed the pilot exactly where I intended to be and told him to give me 3 days to get there. He promised to fly over and make the drop as soon thereafter as the weather permitted. On May 6th, I set up a base camp on the ice cap, just northeast of the thumb, and waited for the airdrop. For the next 4 days, it snowed, nixing any chance for a flight. Too terrified of crevasses to wander far from camp, I spent most of my time recumbent in the tent. The ceiling was too low to allow my sitting upright, fighting a rising chorus of doubts. As the days passed, I grew increasingly anxious. I had no radio nor any other means of communicating with the outside world. It had been many years since anyone had visited this part of the Stikine ice cap, and many more would likely pass before anyone would again. I was nearly out of stove fuel and down to a single chunk of cheese, my last package of ramen noodles, and half a box of Cocoa Puffs. This, I figured, could sustain me for 3 or 4 more days if need be. But then what would I do? It would only take 2 days to ski back down the Baird to Thomas Bay, but a week or more might easily pass before a fisherman happened by who could give me a lift back to Petersburg. The tree planters, with whom I'd ridden over, were camped 15 miles down the impassable headland-studded coast and could be reached only by boat or plane. When I went to bed on the evening of May 10th, it was still snowing and blowing hard. Hours later, I heard a faint, momentary whine, scarcely louder than a mosquito. I tore open the tent door. Most of the clouds had lifted, but there was no airplane in sight. The whine returned, more insistently this time. Then I saw it, a tiny red and white fleck high in the western sky, droning my way. A few minutes later, the plane passed directly overhead. The pilot, however, was unaccustomed to glacier flying, and he'd badly misjudged the scale of the terrain. Worried about flying too low and getting nailed by unexpected turbulence, he stayed at least 1,000 feet above me, believing all the while he was just off the deck, and never saw my tent in the flat evening light. My waving and screaming were to no avail. From his altitude, I was indistinguishable from a pile of rocks. For the next hour, he circled the ice cap, scanning its barren contours without success. But the pilot, to his credit, appreciated the gravity of my predicament and didn't give up. Frantic, I tied my sleeping bag to the end of one of the curtain rods and waved it for all I was worth. The plane banked sharply and headed straight at me. The pilot buzzed my tent 3 times in quick succession, dropping 2 boxes on each pass. Then the airplane disappeared over a ridge, and I was alone. As silence again settled over the glacier, I felt abandoned, vulnerable, lost. I realized that I was sobbing. Embarrassed, I halted the blubbering by screaming obscenities until I grew hoarse. I awoke early on May 11th to clear skies and the relatively warm temperature of 20 degrees Fahrenheit. Startled by the good weather, mentally unprepared to commence the actual climb, I hurriedly packed up a rucksack nonetheless and began skiing toward the base of the Thumb. Two previous Alaska expeditions had taught me that I couldn't afford to waste a rare day of perfect weather. A small hanging glacier extends out from the lip of the ice cap, leading up and across the north face of the Thumb like a catwalk. My plan was to follow this catwalk to a prominent rock prow in the center of the wall and thereby execute an end run around the ugly avalanche-swept lower half of the face. The catwalk turned out to be a series of 50-degree ice fields, blanketed with knee-deep powder snow and riddled with crevasses. The depth of the snow made the going slow and exhausting. By the time I front-pointed up the overhanging wall of the uppermost Bergschrund, some 3 or 4 hours after leaving camp, I was thrashed, and I hadn't even gotten to the real climbing yet. That would begin immediately above, where the hanging glacier gives way to vertical rock. The rock, exhibiting a dearth of holds and coated with 6 inches of crumbly rime, did not look promising, but just left of the main prow was a shallow corner, glazed with frozen meltwater. This ribbon of ice led straight up for 300 feet, and if the ice proved substantial enough to support the picks of my ice axes, the route might be feasible. I shuffled over to the bottom of the corner and gingerly swung one of my tools into the 2-inch-thick ice. Solid and plastic, it was thinner than I would have liked, but otherwise encouraging. The climbing was steep and so exposed it made my head spin. Beneath my Vibram soles, the wall fell away for 3,000 feet to the dirty, avalanche-scarred cirque of the Witch's Cauldron Glacier. Above, the prow soared with authority toward the summit ridge, a vertical half-mile above. Each time I planted one of my ice axes, that distance shrank by another 20 inches. All that held me to the mountainside, all that held me to the world, were 2 thin spikes of crone molybdenum stuck 1/2 inch into a smear of frozen water. Yet the higher I climbed, the more comfortable I became. Early on a difficult climb, especially a difficult solo climb, you constantly feel the abyss pulling at your back. To resist takes a tremendous conscious effort. You don't dare let your guard down for an instant. The siren song of the void puts you on edge. It makes your movements tentative, clumsy, herky-jerky. But as the climb goes on, you grow accustomed to the exposure. You get used to rubbing shoulders with doom. You come to believe in the reliability of your hands and feet and head. You learn to trust your self-control. By and by, your attention becomes so intensely focused that you no longer notice the raw knuckles, the cramping thighs, the strain of maintaining non-stop concentration. A trance-like state settles over your efforts. The climb becomes a clear-eyed dream. Hours slide by like minutes. The accumulated clutter of day-to-day existence, the lapses of conscience, the unpaid bills, the bungled opportunities, the dust under the couch, the inescapable prison of your genes, all of it is temporarily forgotten, crowded from your thoughts by an overpowering clarity of purpose and by the seriousness of the task at hand. At such moments, something resembling happiness actually stirs in your chest, but it isn't the sort of emotion you want to lean on very hard. In solo climbing, the whole enterprise is held together with little more than chutzpah, not the most reliable adhesive. Late in the day on the north face of the Thumb, I felt the glue disintegrate with a swing of an ice axe. I'd gained nearly 700 feet of altitude since stepping off the hanging glacier, all of it on crampon front points and the picks of my axes. The ribbon of frozen meltwater had ended 300 feet up and was followed by a crumbly armor of frost feathers. Though just barely substantial enough to support body weight, the rime was plastered over the rock to a thickness of 2 or 3 feet, so I kept plugging upward. The wall, however, had been growing imperceptibly steeper, and as it did so, the frost feathers became thinner. I'd fallen into a slow, hypnotic rhythm. Swing, swing, kick, kick, swing, swing, kick, kick, when my left ice axe slammed into a slab of diorite a few inches beneath the rime. I tried left, then right, but kept striking rock. The frost feathers holding me up, it became apparent, were maybe 5 inches thick and had the structural integrity of stale cornbread. Below was 3,700 feet of air, and I was balanced on a house of cards. The sour taste of panic rose in my throat. My eyesight blurred, I began to hyperventilate. My calves started to shake. I shuffled a few feet farther to the right, hoping to find thicker ice, but managed only to bend an ice axe on the rock. Awkwardly, stiff with fear, I started working my way back down. The rime gradually thickened. After descending about 80 feet, I got back on reasonably solid ground. I stopped for a long time to let my nerves settle, then leaned back from my tools and stared up at the face above, searching for a hint of solid ice, for some variation in the underlying rock strata, for anything that would allow passage over the frosted slabs. I looked until my neck ached, but nothing appeared. The climb was over. The only place to go was down. Chapter 15. The Stickeen Ice Cap. But we little know until tried how much of the uncontrollable there is in us, urging across glaciers and torrents and up dangerous heights. Let the judgment forbid as it may. John Muir, The Mountains of California. But have you noticed the slight curl at the end of Sam the Second's mouth when he looks at you? It means that he didn't want you to name him Sam the Second, for one thing. And for two other things, it means that he has a sawed-off in his left pant leg and a bailing hook in his right pant leg, and is ready to kill you with either one of them, given the opportunity. The father is taken aback. What he usually says in such a confrontation is, "I changed your diapers for you, little snot." This is not the right thing to say. First, it is not true. Mothers change 9 diapers out of 10. And second, it instantly reminds Sam the Second of what he is mad about. He is mad about being small when you were big. But no, that's not it. He is mad about being helpless when you were powerful. But no, not that either. He is mad about being contingent when you were necessary. Not quite it. He is insane, because when he loved you, you didn't notice. Donald Barthelm, The Dead Father. After coming down from the side of the Devil's Thumb, heavy snow and high winds kept me inside the tent for most of the next 3 days. The hours passed slowly. In the attempt to hurry them along, I chain-smoked for as long as my supply of cigarettes held out, and I read. When I ran out of reading matter, I was reduced to studying the ripstop pattern woven into the tent ceiling. This I did for hours on end, flat on my back, while engaging in a heated self-debate. Should I leave for the coast as soon as the weather broke, or should I stay put long enough to make another attempt on the mountain? In truth, my escapade on the north face had rattled me, and I didn't want to go up on the thumb again at all. But the thought of returning to Boulder in defeat wasn't very appealing either. I could all too easily picture the smug expressions of condolence I'd received from those who'd been certain of my failure from the get-go. By the third afternoon of the storm, I couldn't stand it any longer. The lumps of frozen snow poking me in the back, the clammy nylon walls brushing against my face, the incredible smell drifting up from the depths of my sleeping bag. I pawed through the mess at my feet until I located a small green sack, in which there was a metal film can containing the makings of what I'd hoped would be a sort of victory cigar. I'd intended to save it for my return from the summit, but what the hey, it wasn't looking like I'd be visiting the top any time soon. I poured most of the can's contents onto a leaf of cigarette paper, rolled it into a crooked joint, and promptly smoked it down to the roach. The marijuana, of course, only made the tent seem even more cramped, more suffocating, more impossible to bear. It also made me terribly hungry. I decided a little oatmeal would put things right. Making it, however, was a long, ridiculously involved process. A pot full of snow had to be gathered outside in the tempest, the stove assembled and lit, the oatmeal and sugar located, the remnants of yesterday's dinner scraped from my bowl. I'd gotten the stove going and was melting the snow when I smelled something burning. A thorough check of the stove and its environs revealed nothing. Mystified, I was ready to chalk it up to my chemically enhanced imagination when I heard something crackle at my back. I spun around in time to see a bag of garbage, into which I'd tossed the match I'd used to light the stove, flare into a small conflagration. Beating on the fire with my hands, I had it out in a few seconds, but not before a large section of the tent's inner wall vaporized before my eyes. The built-in fly escaped the flames, so it was still more or less weatherproof. Now, however, it was approximately 30 degrees colder inside. My left palm began to sting. Examining it, I noticed the pink welt of a burn. What troubled me most, though, was that the tent wasn't even mine. I'd borrowed the expensive shelter from my father. It was new before my trip. The hang tags had still been attached, and had been lent reluctantly. For several minutes I sat dumbstruck, staring at the wreckage of the tent's once graceful form amid the acrid scent of singed hair and melted nylon. You had to hand it to me, I thought. I had a knack for living up to the old man's worst expectations. My father was a volatile, extremely complicated person, possessed of a brash demeanor that masked deep insecurities. If he ever in his entire life admitted to being wrong, I wasn't there to witness it. But it was my father, a weekend mountaineer, who taught me to climb. He bought me my first rope and ice axe when I was 8 years old and led me into the Cascade Range to make an assault on the South Sister, a gentle 10,000-foot volcano not far from our Oregon home. It never occurred to him that I would one day try to shape my life around climbing. A kind and generous man, Lewis Krakauer loved his five children deeply, in the autocratic way of fathers, but his worldview was colored by a relentlessly competitive nature. Life, as he saw it, was a contest. He read and reread the works of Stephen Potter, the English writer who coined the terms one-upmanship and gamesmanship, not as social satire, but as a manual of practical stratagems. He was ambitious in the extreme, and like Walt McCandless, his aspirations extended to his progeny. Before I'd even enrolled in kindergarten, he began preparing me for a shining career in medicine, or, failing that, law as a poor consolation. For Christmas and birthdays, I received such gifts as a microscope, a chemistry set, and the Encyclopedia Britannica. From elementary school through high school, my siblings and I were hectored to excel in every class, to win medals in science fairs, to be chosen princess of the prom, to win election to student government. Thereby, and only thereby, we learned, could we expect to gain admission to the right college, which in turn would get us into Harvard Medical School, life's one sure path to meaningful success and lasting happiness. My father's faith in this blueprint was unshakable. It was, after all, the path he had followed to prosperity. But I was not a clone of my father. During my teens, as I came to this realization, I veered gradually from the plotted course, and then sharply. My insurrection prompted a great deal of yelling. The windows of our home rattled with the thunder of ultimatums. By the time I left Corvallis, Oregon, to enroll in a distant college where no ivy grew, I was speaking to my father with a clenched jaw, or not at all. When I graduated 4 years later and did not enter Harvard or any other medical school, but became a carpenter and climbing bum instead, the unbridgeable gulf between us widened. I had been granted unusual freedom and responsibility at an early age, for which I should have been grateful in the extreme, but I wasn't. Instead, I felt oppressed by the old man's expectations. It was drilled into me that anything less than winning was failure. In the impressionable way of sons, I did not consider this rhetorically. I took him at his word. And that's why later, when long-held family secrets came to light, when I noticed that this deity who asked only for perfection was himself less than perfect, that he was in fact not a deity at all, well, I wasn't able to shrug it off. I was consumed instead by a blinding rage. The revelation that he was merely human, and frightfully so, was beyond my power to forgive. 2 decades after the fact, I discovered that my rage was gone, and had been for years. It had been supplanted by a rueful sympathy, and something not unlike affection. I came to understand that I had baffled and infuriated my father, at least as much as he had baffled and infuriated me. I saw that I had been selfish and unbending, and a giant pain in the ass. He'd built a bridge of privilege for me, a hand-paved trestle to the good life, and I repaid him by chopping it down and crapping on the wreckage. But this epiphany occurred only after the intervention of time and misfortune, when my father's self-satisfied existence had begun to crumble beneath him. It began with the betrayal of his flesh. 30 years after a bout with polio, the symptoms mysteriously flared anew. Crippled muscles withered further, synapses wouldn't fire, wasted legs refused to ambulate. From medical journals, he deduced that he was suffering from a newly identified ailment known as post-polio syndrome. Pain, excruciating at times, filled his days like a shrill and constant noise. In an ill-advised attempt to halt the decline, he started medicating himself. He never went anywhere without a faux leather valise stuffed with dozens of orange plastic pill bottles. Every hour or two, he would fumble through the drug bag, squinting at the labels, and shake out tablets of Dexedrine and Prozac and Deprenil. He gulped pills by the fistful, grimacing without water. Used syringes and empty ampules appeared on the bathroom sink. To a greater and greater degree, his life revolved around a self-administered pharmacopoeia of steroids, amphetamines, mood elevators, and painkillers, and the drugs addled his once formidable mind. As his behavior became more and more irrational, more and more delusional, the last of his friends were driven away. My long-suffering mother finally had no choice but to move out. My father crossed the line into madness, and then very nearly succeeded in taking his own life, an act at which he made sure I was present. After the suicide attempt, he was placed in a psychiatric hospital near Portland. When I visited him there, his arms and legs were strapped to the rails of his bed. He was ranting incoherently and had soiled himself. His eyes were wild, flashing in defiance one moment, in uncomprehending terror the next. They rolled far back in their sockets, giving a clear and chilling view into the state of his tortured mind. When the nurses tried to change his linens, he thrashed against his restraints and cursed them, cursed me, cursed the fates. That his foolproof life plan had in the end transported him here, to this nightmarish station, was an irony that brought me no pleasure and escaped his notice altogether. There was another irony he failed to appreciate. His struggle to mold me in his image had been successful after all. The old walrus, in fact, managed to instill in me a great and burning ambition. It had simply found expression in an unintended pursuit. He never understood that the devil's thumb was the same as medical school, only different. I suppose it was this inherited off-kilter ambition that kept me from admitting defeat on the sticky nice cap after my initial attempt to climb the thumb had failed, even after nearly burning the tent down. 3 days after retreating from my first try, I went up on the north face again. This time I climbed only 120 feet above the Bergschrund before lack of composure and the arrival of a snow squall forced me to turn around. Instead of descending to my base camp on the ice cap, though, I decided to spend the night on the steep flank of the mountain, just below my high point. This proved to be a mistake. By late afternoon, the squall had metastasized into another major storm. Snow fell from the clouds at the rate of an inch an hour. As I crouched inside my bivouac sack, under the lip of the Bergschrund, spindrift avalanches hissed down from the wall above me and washed over me like surf, slowly burying my ledge. It took about 20 minutes for the spindrift to inundate my bivy sack, a thin nylon envelope shaped exactly like a baggy sandwich bag, only bigger, to the level of the breathing slit. 4 times this happened, and 4 times I dug myself out. After the 5th burial, I'd had enough. I threw all my gear into my pack and made a break for the base camp. The descent was terrifying. Because of the clouds, the ground blizzard, and the flat, fading light, I couldn't tell slope from sky. I worried, with ample reason, that I might step blindly off the top of a serac and end up at the bottom of the witch's cauldron, a vertical half-mile below. When I finally arrived on the frozen plain of the ice cap, I found that my tracks had long since drifted over. I didn't have a clue as to how to locate the tent on the featureless glacial plateau. Hoping I'd get lucky and stumble across my camp, I skied in circles for an hour, until I put a foot into a small crevasse and realized that I was acting like an idiot, that I should hunker down right where I was and wait out the storm. I dug a shallow hole, wrapped myself in the bivy bag, and sat on my pack in the swirling snow. Drifts piled up around me. My feet became numb. A damp chill crept down my chest from the base of my neck, where spindrift had gotten inside my parka and soaked my shirt. If only I had a cigarette, I thought, a single cigarette, I could summon the strength of character to put a good face on this fucked-up situation, on the whole fucked-up trip. I pulled the bivy sack tighter around my shoulders. The wind ripped at my back. Beyond shame, I cradled my head in my arms and embarked on an orgy of self-pity. I knew that people sometimes died climbing mountains, but at the age of 23, personal mortality, the idea of my own death, was still largely outside my conceptual grasp. When I decamped from Boulder for Alaska, my head swimming with visions of glory and redemption on the Devil's Thumb, it didn't occur to me that I might be bound by the same cause and effect relationships that governed the actions of others. Because I wanted to climb the mountain so badly, because I had thought about the thumb so intensely for so long, it seemed beyond the realm of possibility that some minor obstacle like the weather, or crevasses, or rime-covered rock might ultimately thwart my will. At sunset, the wind died, and the ceiling lifted 150 feet off the glacier, enabling me to locate my base camp. I made it back to the tent intact, but it was no longer possible to ignore the fact that the thumb had made hash of my plans. I was forced to acknowledge that volition alone, however powerful, was not going to get me up the north wall. I saw finally that nothing was. There still existed an opportunity for salvaging the expedition, however. A week earlier, I'd skied over to the southeast side of the mountain to take a look at the route by which I'd intended to descend the peak after climbing the north wall, a route that Fred Becky, the legendary alpinist, had followed in 1946 in making the first ascent of the thumb. During my reconnaissance, I'd noticed an obvious unclimbed line to the left of the Becky route, a patchy network of ice angling across the southeast face, that struck me as a relatively easy way to achieve the summit. At the time, I'd considered this route unworthy of my attentions. Now, on the rebound from my calamitous entanglement with the Nordvand, I was prepared to lower my sights. On the afternoon of May 15th, when the blizzard finally abated, I returned to the southeast face and climbed to the top of a slender ridge that abuts the upper peak like a flying buttress on a Gothic cathedral. I decided to spend the night there, on the narrow crest, 1,600 feet below the summit. The evening sky was cold and cloudless. I could see all the way to Tidewater and beyond. At dusk, I watched, transfixed, as the lights of Petersburg blinked on in the west. The closest thing I'd had to human contact since the airdrop, the distant lights triggered a flood of emotion that caught me off guard. I imagined people watching baseball on television, eating fried chicken in brightly lit kitchens, drinking beer, making love. When I lay down to sleep, I was overcome by a wrenching loneliness. I'd never felt so alone, ever. That night, I had troubled dreams of a police bust and vampires and a gangland-style execution. I heard someone whisper, "I think he's in there." I sat bolt upright and opened my eyes. The sun was about to rise. The entire sky was scarlet. It was still clear, but a thin, wispy scum of cirrus had spread across the upper atmosphere, and a dark line of squalls was visible just above the southwestern horizon. I pulled on my boots and hurriedly strapped on my crampons. 5 minutes after waking up, I was climbing away from the bivouac. I carried no rope, no tent or bivouac gear, no hardware save my ice axes. My plan was to go light and fast, to reach the summit and make it back down before the weather turned. Pushing myself, continually out of breath, I scurried up and to the left across small snowfields linked by ice-choked clefts and short rock steps. The climbing was almost fun. The rock was covered with large, in-cut holds, and the ice, though thin, never got steeper than 70 degrees. But I was anxious about the storm front racing in from the Pacific, darkening the sky. I didn't have a watch, but in what seemed like a very short time, I was on the distinctive final ice field. By now, the entire sky was smeared with clouds. It looked easier to keep angling to the left, but quicker to go straight for the top. Anxious about being caught by a storm high on the peak and without shelter, I opted for the direct route. The ice steepened and thinned. I swung my left ice axe and struck rock. I aimed for another spot, and once again it glanced off unyielding diorite with a dull clank. And again, and again. It was a reprise of my first attempt on the north face. Looking between my legs, I stole a glance at the glacier more than 2,000 feet below. My stomach churned. 45 feet above me, the wall eased back onto the sloping summit shoulder. I clung stiffly to my axes, unmoving, racked by terror and indecision. Again I looked down at the long drop to the glacier, then up, then scraped away the patina of ice above my head. I hooked the pick of my left axe on a nickel-thin lip of rock and weighted it. It held. I pulled my right axe from the ice, reached up, and twisted the pick into a crooked half-inch fissure until it jammed. Barely breathing now, I moved my feet up, scrabbling my crampon points across the verglas. Reaching as high as I could with my left arm, I swung the axe gently at the shiny, opaque surface, not knowing what I'd hit beneath it. The pick went in with a solid whunk. A few minutes later, I was standing on a broad ledge. The summit proper, a slender rock fin sprouting a grotesque meringue of atmospheric ice, stood 20 feet directly above. The insubstantial frost feathers ensured that those last 20 feet remained hard, scary, onerous. But then suddenly, there was no place higher to go. I felt my cracked lips stretch into a painful grin. I was on top of the Devil's Thumb. Fittingly, the summit was a surreal, malevolent place, an improbable slender wedge of rock and rime, no wider than a file cabinet. It did not encourage loitering. As I straddled the highest point, the south face fell away beneath my right boot for 2,500 feet. Beneath my left boot, the north face dropped twice that distance. I took some pictures to prove I'd been there and spent a few minutes trying to straighten a bent pick. Then I stood up, carefully turned around, and headed for home. 1 week later, I was camped in the rain beside the sea, marveling at the sight of moss, willows, mosquitoes. The salt air carried the rich stink of tidal life. By and by, a small skiff motored into Thomas Bay and pulled up on the beach not far from my tent. The man driving the boat introduced himself as Jim Freeman, a timber faller from Petersburg. It was his day off, he said. He'd made the trip to show his family the glacier and to look for bears. He asked me if I'd been hunting or what. No, I replied sheepishly. Actually, I just climbed the Devil's Thumb. I've been over here 20 days. Freeman fiddled with a deck cleat and said nothing. It became obvious that he didn't believe me. Nor did he seem to approve of my snarled shoulder-length hair or the way I smelled after having gone 3 weeks without bathing or changing my clothes. When I asked if he could give me a lift back to town, however, he offered a grudging, "I don't see why not." The water was choppy, and the ride across Frederick Sound took 2 hours. Freeman gradually warmed to me as we talked. He still wasn't convinced I'd climbed the thumb, but by the time he steered the skiff into Wrangell Narrows, he pretended to be. After docking the boat, he insisted on buying me a cheeseburger. That evening, he invited me to spend the night in a junk step van parked in his backyard. I lay down in the rear of the old truck for a while, but couldn't sleep, so I got up and walked to a bar called Keto's Cave. The euphoria, the overwhelming sense of relief that had initially accompanied my return to Petersburg faded, and an unexpected melancholy took its place. The people I chatted with in Keto's didn't seem to doubt that I'd been to the top of the thumb. They just didn't much care. As the night wore on, the place emptied except for me and an old toothless Tlingit man at a back table. I drank alone, putting quarters into the jukebox, playing the same 5 songs over and over until the barmaid yelled angrily, "Hey, give it a fucking rest, kid." I mumbled an apology, headed for the door, and lurched back to Freeman's step van. There, surrounded by the sweet scent of old motor oil, I lay down on the floorboards next to a gutted transmission and passed out. Less than a month after sitting on the summit of the thumb, I was back in Boulder, nailing up siding on the Spruce Street townhouses, the same condos I'd been framing when I left for Alaska. I got a raise to $4 an hour, and at the end of the summer moved out of the job site trailer to a cheap studio apartment west of the downtown mall. It is easy, when you are young, to believe that what you desire is no less than what you deserve, to assume that if you want something badly enough, It is your God-given right to have it. When I decided to go to Alaska that April, like Chris McCandless, I was a raw youth who mistook passion for insight and acted according to an obscure, gap-ridden logic. I thought climbing the Devil's Thumb would fix all that was wrong with my life. In the end, of course, it changed almost nothing. But I came to appreciate that mountains make poor receptacles for dreams, and I lived to tell my tale. As a young man, I was unlike McCandless in many important regards. Most notably, I possessed neither his intellect nor his lofty ideals. But I believe we were similarly affected by the skewed relationships we had with our fathers, and I suspect we had a similar intensity, a similar heedlessness, a similar agitation of the soul. The fact that I survived my Alaska adventure and McCandless did not survive his was largely a matter of chance. Had I not returned from the Stickeen ice cap in 1977, people would have been quick to say of me, as they now say of him, that I had a death wish. 18 years after the event, I now recognize that I suffered from hubris, perhaps, and an appalling innocence, certainly. But I wasn't suicidal. At that stage of my youth, death remained as abstract a concept as non-Euclidean geometry or marriage. I didn't yet appreciate its terrible finality or the havoc it could wreak on those who'd entrusted the deceased with their hearts. I was stirred by the dark mystery of mortality. I couldn't resist stealing up to the edge of doom and peering over the brink. The hint of what was concealed in those shadows terrified me, but I caught sight of something in the glimpse, some forbidden and elemental riddle that was no less compelling than the sweet, hidden petals of a woman's sex. In my case, and I believe in the case of Chris McCandless, that was a very different thing from wanting to die. Chapter 16. The Alaska Interior. I wished to acquire the simplicity, native feelings, and virtues of savage life, to divest myself of the factitious habits, prejudices, and imperfections of civilization, and to find amidst the solitude and grandeur of the western wilds more correct views of human nature and of the true interests of man. The season of snows was preferred, that I might experience the pleasure of suffering and the novelty of danger. Estwick Evans, A Pedestrious Tour of 4,000 Miles Through the Western States and Territories During the Winter and Spring of 1818. Wilderness appealed to those bored or disgusted with man and his works. It not only offered an escape from society, but also was an ideal stage for the romantic individual to exercise the cult that he frequently made of his own soul. The solitude and total freedom of the wilderness created a perfect setting for either melancholy or exaltation. Roderick Nash, Wilderness and the American Mind. On April 15, 1992, Chris McCandless departed Carthage, South Dakota, in the cab of a Mack truck hauling a load of sunflower seeds. His great Alaskan odyssey was underway. 3 days later, he crossed the Canadian border at Rouseville, British Columbia, and thumbed north through Skookumchuck and Radium Junction, Lake Louise and Jasper, Prince George and Dawson Creek, where, in the town center, he took a snapshot of the signpost marking the official start of the Alaska Highway. Mile zero, the sign reads, Fairbanks, 1,523 miles. Hitchhiking tends to be difficult on the Alaska Highway. It's not unusual on the outskirts of Dawson Creek to see a dozen or more doleful-looking men and women standing along the shoulder with extended thumbs. Some of them may wait a week or more between rides. But McCandless experienced no such delay. On April 21st, just 6 days out of Carthage, he arrived at Leard River Hot Springs, at the threshold of the Yukon Territory. There is a public campground at Leard River, from which a boardwalk leads half a mile across a marsh to a series of natural thermal pools. It is the most popular way stop on the Alaska Highway, and McCandless decided to pause there for a soak in the soothing waters. When he finished bathing and attempted to catch another ride north, however, he discovered that his luck had changed. Nobody would pick him up. 2 days after arriving, he was still at Leard River, impatiently going nowhere. At 6:30, on a brisk Thursday morning, the ground still frozen hard, Gaylord Stuckey walked out on the boardwalk to the largest of the pools, expecting to have the place to himself. He was surprised, therefore, to find someone already in the steaming water, a young man who introduced himself as Alex. Stucky, bald and cheerful, a ham-faced 63-year-old Hoosier, was en route from Indiana to Alaska to deliver a new motorhome to a Fairbanks RV dealer, a part-time line of work in which he'd dabbled since retiring after 40 years in the restaurant business. When he told McCandless his destination, the boy exclaimed, "Hey, that's where I'm going too. But I've been stuck here for a couple of days now trying to get a lift. You mind if I ride with you?" "Aw, Jiminy," Stucky replied. "I'd love to, son, but I can't. The company I work for has a strict rule against picking up hitchhikers. It could get me canned." As he chatted with McCandless through the sulfurous mist, though, Stucky began to reconsider. Alex was clean-shaven and had short hair, and I could tell by the language he used that he was a real sharp fella. He wasn't what you'd call a typical hitchhiker. I'm usually leery of him. I figure there's probably something wrong with a guy if he can't even afford a bus ticket. So anyway, after about half an hour, I said, "I tell you what, Alex, Leard is 1,000 miles from Fairbanks. I'll take you 500 miles, as far as Whitehorse. You'll be able to get a ride the rest of the way from there." A day and a half later, however, when they arrived in Whitehorse, the capital of the Yukon Territory and the largest, most cosmopolitan town on the Alaska Highway, Stucky had come to enjoy McCandless's company so much that he changed his mind and agreed to drive the boy the entire distance. "Alex didn't come out and say too much at first," Stucky reports, "but it's a long, slow drive. We spent a total of 3 days together on those washboard roads, and by the end, he kind of let his guard down. I tell you what, he was a dandy kid. Real courteous, and he didn't cuss or use a lot of that there slang. You could tell he came from a nice family. Mostly he talked about his sister. He didn't get along with his folks too good, I guess. Told me his dad was a genius, a NASA rocket scientist, but he'd been a bigamist at one time, and that kind of went against Alex's grain. Said he hadn't seen his parents in a couple of years, since his college graduation." McCandless was candid with Stucky about his intent to spend the summer alone in the bush, living off the land. "He said it was something he'd wanted to do since he was little," says Stucky. "Said he didn't want to see a single person, no airplanes, no sign of civilization. He wanted to prove to himself that he could make it on his own, without anybody else's help." Stucky and McCandless arrived in Fairbanks on the afternoon of April 25th. The older man took the boy to a grocery store, where he bought a big bag of rice, and then Alex said he wanted to go out to the university to study up on what kind of plants he could eat, berries and things like that. I told him, "Alex, you're too early. There's still 2 foot, 3 foot of snow on the ground. There's nothing growing yet." But his mind was pretty well made up. He was champing at the bit to get out there and start hiking. Stucky drove to the University of Alaska campus on the west end of Fairbanks and dropped McCandless off at 5:30 p.m. "Before I let him out," Stucky says, "I told him, 'Alex, I've driven you 1,000 miles. I've fed you and fed you for 3 straight days. The least you can do is send me a letter when you get back from Alaska.' And he promised he would. I also begged and pleaded with him to call his parents. I can't imagine anything worse than having a son out there and not knowing where he's at for years and years, not knowing whether he's living or dead. 'Here's my credit card number,' I told him. 'Please, call them.' But all he said was, 'Maybe I will and maybe I won't.' After he left, I thought, 'Oh, why didn't I get his parents' phone number and call them myself?' But everything just kind of happened so quick." After dropping McCandless at the university, Stucky drove into town to deliver the RV to the appointed dealer, only to be told that the person responsible for checking in new vehicles had already gone home for the day and wouldn't be back until Monday morning, leaving Stucky with 2 days to kill in Fairbanks before he could fly home to Indiana. On Sunday morning, with time on his hands, he returned to the campus. "I hope to find Alex and spend another day with him, take him sightseeing or something. I looked for a couple of hours, drove all over the place, but didn't see hide or hair of him. He was already gone." After taking his leave of Stucky on Saturday evening, McCandless spent 2 days and 3 nights in the vicinity of Fairbanks, mostly at the university. In the campus bookstore, tucked away on the bottom shelf of the Alaska section, he came across a scholarly, exhaustively researched field guide to the region's edible plants. Tanaina plant lore, Denaina Ketuna, an ethnobotany of the Dena'ina Indians of South Central Alaska, by Priscilla Russell Carey. From a postcard rack near the cash register, he picked out two cards of a polar bear, on which he sent his final messages to Wayne Westerberg and Jan Burris from the University Post Office. Perusing the classified ads, McCandless found a used gun to buy, a semi-automatic .22-caliber Remington, with a .420 scope and a plastic stock. A model called the Nylon 66, no longer in production, it was a favorite of Alaska trappers because of its lightweight and reliability. He closed the deal in a parking lot, probably paying about $125 for the weapon, and then purchased 4 100-round boxes of hollow-point long rifle shells from a nearby gun shop. At the conclusion of his preparations in Fairbanks, McCandless loaded up his pack and started hiking west from the university. Leaving the campus, he walked past the Geophysical Institute, a tall glass-and-concrete building capped with a large satellite dish. The dish, one of the most distinctive landmarks on the Fairbanks skyline, had been erected to collect data from satellites equipped with synthetic aperture radar of Walt McCandless's design. Walt had in fact visited Fairbanks during the startup of the receiving station and had written some of the software crucial to its operation. If the Geophysical Institute prompted Chris to think of his father as he tramped by, the boy left no record of it. 4 miles west of town, in the evening's deepening chill, McCandless pitched his tent on a patch of hard, frozen ground surrounded by birch trees, not far from the crest of a bluff overlooking Gold Hill Gas and Liquor. 50 yards from his camp was the terraced road cut of the George Parks Highway, the road that would take him to the Stampede Trail. He woke early on the morning of April 28th, walked down to the highway in the pre-dawn gloaming, and was pleasantly surprised when the first vehicle to come along pulled over to give him a lift. It was a gray Ford pickup with a bumper sticker on the back that declared, "I fish, therefore I am. Petersburg, Alaska." The driver of the truck, an electrician on his way to Anchorage, wasn't much older than McCandless. He said his name was Jim Galleon. 3 hours later, Galleon turned his truck west off the highway and drove as far as he could down an unplowed side road. When he dropped McCandless off on the Stampede Trail, the temperature was in the low 30s. It would drop into the low teens at night, and a foot and a half of crusty spring snow covered the ground. The boy could hardly contain his excitement. He was at long last about to be alone in the vast Alaska wilds. As he trudged expectantly down the trail in a fake fur parka, his rifle slung over one shoulder, the only food McCandless carried was a 10-pound bag of long-grained rice and the 2 sandwiches and bag of corn chips that Galleon had contributed. A year earlier, he'd subsisted for more than a month beside the Gulf of California on 5 pounds of rice and a bounty of fish caught with a cheap rod and reel, an experience that made him confident he could harvest enough food to survive an extended stay in the Alaska wilderness, too. The heaviest item in McCandless's half-full backpack was his library, 9 or 10 paper-bound books, most of which had been given to him by Jan Burris in Nyland. Among these volumes were titles by Thoreau and Tolstoy and Gogol, but McCandless was no literary snob. He simply carried what he thought he might enjoy reading, including mass-market books by Michael Crichton, Robert Persig, and Louis L'Amour. Having neglected to pack writing paper, he began a laconic journal on some blank pages in the back of Tanina Plant Lore. The Healy terminus of the Stampede Trail is traveled by a handful of dog mushers, ski tourers, and snow machine enthusiasts during the winter months, but only until the frozen rivers begin to break up in late March or early April. By the time McCandless headed into the bush, there was open water flowing on most of the larger streams, and nobody had been very far down the trail for 2 or 3 weeks. Only the faint remnants of a packed snow machine track remained for him to follow. McCandless reached the Teklanika River his second day out. Although the banks were lined with a jagged shelf of frozen overflow, no ice bridges spanned the channel of open water, so he was forced to wade. There had been a big thaw in early April, and breakup had come early in 1992, but the weather had turned cold again, so the river's volume was quite low when McCandless crossed, probably thigh-deep at most, allowing him to splash to the other side without difficulty. He never suspected that in so doing he was crossing his Rubicon. To McCandless's inexperienced eye, there was nothing to suggest that 2 months hence, as the glaciers and snowfields at the Teklanika's headwater thawed in the summer heat, its discharge would multiply 9 or 10 times in volume, transforming the river into a deep, violent torrent that bore no resemblance to the gentle brook he'd blithely waded across in April. From his journal, we know that on April 29th, McCandless fell through the ice somewhere. It probably happened as he traversed a series of melting beaver ponds just beyond the Teklanika's western bank, but there is nothing to indicate that he suffered any harm in the mishap. A day later, as the trail crested a ridge, he got his first glimpse of Mount McKinley's high, blinding white bulwarks, and a day after that, May 1st, some 20 miles down the trail from where he was dropped by Galleon, he stumbled upon the old bus beside the Shoshana River. It was outfitted with a bunk and a barrel stove, and previous visitors had left the improvised shelter stocked with matches, bug dope, and other essentials. "Magic bus day," he wrote in his journal. He decided to lay over for a while in the vehicle and take advantage of its crude comforts. He was elated to be there. Inside the bus, on a sheet of weathered plywood spanning a broken window, McCandless scrawled an exultant declaration of independence. 2 years he walks the earth. No phone, no pool, no pets, no cigarettes. Ultimate freedom. An extremist. An aesthetic voyager whose home is the road. Escaped from Atlanta, thou shalt not return, 'cause the West is the best. And now, after 2 rambling years, comes the final and greatest adventure. The climactic battle to kill the false being within and victoriously conclude the spiritual revolution. 10 days and nights of freight trains and hitchhiking bring him to the great white north. No longer to be poisoned by civilization, he flees, and walks alone upon the land, to become lost in the wild. Alexander Supertramp, May 1992. Reality, however, was quick to intrude on McCandless's reverie. He had difficulty killing game, and the daily journal entries during his first week in the bush include weakness, snowed in, and disaster. He saw but did not shoot a grizzly on May 2nd, shot at but missed some ducks on May 4th, and finally killed and ate a spruce grouse on May 5th. But he didn't shoot anything else until May 9th, when he bagged a single small squirrel, by which point he'd written, "Fourth Day Famine," in the journal. But soon thereafter, his fortunes took a sharp turn for the better. By mid-May, the sun was circling high in the heavens, flooding the taiga with light. The sun dipped below the northern horizon for fewer than 4 hours out of every 24, and at midnight the sky was still bright enough to read by. Everywhere but on the north-facing slopes and in the shadowy ravines, the snowpack had melted down to bare ground, exposing the previous season's rose hips and lingonberries, which McCandless gathered and ate in great quantity. He also became much more successful at hunting game, and for the next 6 weeks feasted regularly on squirrel, spruce grouse, duck, goose, and porcupine. On May 22nd, a crown fell off one of his molars, but the event didn't seem to dampen his spirits much, because the following day he scrambled up the nameless, hump-like 3,000-foot butte that rises directly north of the bus, giving him a view of the whole icy sweep of the Alaska Range and mile after mile of uninhabited country. His journal entry for the day is characteristically terse but unmistakably joyous. "Climb mountain." McCandless had told Galleon that he intended to remain on the move during his stay in the bush. "I'm just going to take off and keep walking west," he'd said. "I might walk all the way to the Bering Sea." On May 5th, after pausing for 4 days at the bus, he resumed his perambulation. From the snapshots recovered with his Minolta, it appears that McCandless lost, or intentionally left, the by now indistinct Stampede Trail and headed west and north through the hills above the Shoshana River, hunting game as he went. It was slow going. In order to feed himself, he had to devote a large part of each day to stalking animals. Moreover, as the ground thawed, his route turned into a gauntlet of boggy muskeg and impenetrable alder, and McCandless belatedly came to appreciate one of the fundamental, if counterintuitive, axioms of the North. Winter, not summer, is the preferred season for traveling overland through the bush. Faced with the obvious folly of his original ambition, to walk 500 miles to Tidewater, he reconsidered his plans. On May 19th, having traveled no farther west than the Toklat River, less than 15 miles beyond the bus, he turned around. A week later, he was back at the derelict vehicle, apparently without regret. He'd decided that the Shoshana drainage was plenty wild to suit his purposes, and that Fairbanks Bus 142 would make a fine base camp for the remainder of the summer. Ironically, the wilderness surrounding the bus, the patch of overgrown country where McCandless was determined to become lost in the wild, scarcely qualifies as wilderness by Alaska standards. Less than 30 miles to the east is a major thoroughfare, the George Parks Highway. Just 16 miles to the south, beyond an escarpment of the outer range, hundreds of tourists rumble daily into Denali Park over a road patrolled by the National Park Service. And, unbeknownst to the aesthetic voyager, scattered within a 6-mile radius of the bus are 4 cabins, although none happened to be occupied during the summer of 1992. But despite the relative proximity of the bus to civilization, for all practical purposes, McCandless was cut off from the rest of the world. He spent nearly 4 months in the bush all told, and during that period he didn't encounter another living soul. In the end, the Shoshana River site was sufficiently remote to cost him his life. In the last week of May, after moving his few possessions into the bus, McCandless wrote a list of housekeeping chores on a parchment-like strip of birch bark. Collect and store ice from the river for refrigerating meat. Cover the vehicle's missing windows with plastic. Lay in a supply of firewood. Clean the accumulation of old ash from the stove. And under the heading Long Term, he drew up a list of more ambitious tasks, map the area, improvise a bathtub, collect skins and feathers to sew into clothing, construct a bridge across a nearby creek, repair mess kit, blaze a network of hunting trails. The diary entries following his return to the bus catalog a bounty of wild meat. May 28th, gourmet duck. June 1st, 5 squirrel. June 2nd, porcupine, ptarmigan, 4 squirrel, gray bird. June 3rd, another porcupine, 4 squirrel, 2 gray bird, ash bird. June 4th, a 3rd porcupine, squirrel, gray bird. On June 5th, he shot a Canada goose as big as a Christmas turkey. Then, on June 9th, he bagged the biggest prize of all. Moose, he recorded in the journal. Overjoyed, the proud hunter took a photograph of himself kneeling over his trophy, rifle thrust triumphantly overhead, his features distorted in a rictus of ecstasy and amazement, like some unemployed janitor who'd gone to Reno and won a $1 million jackpot. Although McCandless was enough of a realist to know that hunting game was an unavoidable component of living off the land, he had always been ambivalent about killing animals. That ambivalence turned to remorse soon after he shot the moose. It was relatively small, weighing perhaps 600 or 700 pounds, but it nevertheless amounted to a huge quantity of meat. Believing that it was morally indefensible to waste any part of an animal that has been shot for food, McCandless spent 6 days toiling to preserve what he had killed before it spoiled. He butchered the carcass under a thick cloud of flies and mosquitoes, boiled the organs into a stew, and then laboriously excavated a burrow in the face of the rocky stream bank directly below the bus, in which he tried to cure by smoking the immense slabs of purple flesh. Alaskan hunters know that the easiest way to preserve meat in the bush is to slice it into thin strips and then air-dry it on a makeshift rack. But McCandless, in his naivete, relied on the advice of hunters he'd consulted in South Dakota, who advised him to smoke his meat, not an easy task under the circumstances. "Butchering extremely difficult," he wrote in the journal on June 10th. "Fly and mosquito hordes. Remove intestines, liver, kidneys, 1 lung, steaks. Get hindquarters and leg to stream. June 11th. Remove heart and other lung. 2 front legs and head. Get rest to stream. Haul near cave. Try to protect with smoker. June 12th. Remove half rib cage and steaks. Can only work nights. Keep smokers going. June 13th. Get remainder of rib cage, shoulder, and neck to cave. Start smoking. June 14th. Maggots already. Smoking appears ineffective. Don't know. Looks like disaster. I now wish I had never shot the moose. One of the greatest tragedies of my life. At that point, he gave up on preserving the bulk of the meat and abandoned the carcass to the wolves. Although he castigated himself severely for this waste of a life he'd taken, a day later, McCandless appeared to regain some perspective, for his journal notes, "Henceforth will learn to accept my errors, however great they be." Shortly after the moose episode, McCandless began to read Thoreau's Walden. In the chapter titled Higher Laws, in which Thoreau ruminates on the morality of eating, McCandless highlighted, "When I had caught and cleaned and cooked and eaten my fish, they seemed not to have fed me, essentially. It was insignificant and unnecessary, and cost more than it came to." The moose, McCandless wrote in the margin, and in the same passage he marked, "The repugnance to animal food is not the effect of experience, but is an instinct. It appeared more beautiful to live low and fare hard in many respects, and though I never did so, I went far enough to please my imagination. I believe that every man who has ever been earnest to preserve his higher or poetic faculties in the best condition has been particularly inclined to abstain from animal food, and from much food of any kind. It is hard to provide and cook so simple and clean a diet as will not offend the imagination, but this, I think, is to be fed when we feed the body. They should both sit down at the same table. Yet perhaps this may be done. The fruits, eaten temperately, need not make us ashamed of our appetites, nor interrupt the worthiest pursuits. But put an extra condiment into your dish, and it will poison you." "Yes," wrote McCandless, and 2 pages later, "Consciousness of food. Eat and cook with concentration. Holy food." On the back of the book that served as his journal, he declared, "I am reborn. This is my dawn. Real life has just begun. Deliberate living, conscious attention to the basics of life, and a conscious attention to your immediate environment and its concerns, example, a job, a task, a book, anything requiring efficient concentration. Circumstance has no value. It is how one relates to a situation that has value. All true meaning resides in the personal relationship to a phenomenon, what it means to you. The great holiness of food, the vital heat, positivism, the insurpassable joy of the life aesthetic, absolute truth and honesty, reality, independence, finality, stability, consistency." As McCandless gradually stopped rebuking himself for the waste of the moose, the contentment that began in mid-May resumed and seemed to continue through early July. Then, in the midst of this idyll, came the first of 2 pivotal setbacks. Satisfied, apparently, with what he had learned during his 2 months of solitary life in the wild, McCandless decided to return to civilization. It was time to bring his final and greatest adventure to a close and get himself back to the world of men and women, where he could chug a beer, talk philosophy, enthrall strangers with tales of what he'd done. He seemed to have moved beyond his need to assert so adamantly his autonomy, his need to separate himself from his parents. Maybe he was prepared to forgive their imperfections. Maybe he was even prepared to forgive some of his own. McCandless seemed ready, perhaps, to go home. Or maybe not. We can do no more than speculate about what he intended to do after he walked out of the bush. There is no question, however, that he intended to walk out. Writing on a piece of birch bark, he made a list of things to do before he departed. Patch jeans, shave, organize pack. Shortly thereafter, he propped his Minolta on an empty oil drum and took a snapshot of himself brandishing a yellow disposable razor and grinning at the camera, clean-shaven, with new patches cut from an army blanket stitched onto the knees of his filthy jeans. He looks healthy, but alarmingly gaunt. Already his cheeks are sunken. The tendons in his neck stand out like taut cables. On July 2nd, McCandless finished reading Tolstoy's Family Happiness, having marked several passages that moved him. He was right in saying that the only certain happiness in life is to live for others. "I have lived through much, and now I think I have found what is needed for happiness. A quiet, secluded life in the country, with the possibility of being useful to people to whom it is easy to do good, and who are not accustomed to have it done to them. Then work, which one hopes may be of some use. Then rest, nature, books, music, love for one's neighbor. Such is my idea of happiness. And then, on top of all that, you for a mate, and children perhaps. What more can the heart of a man desire? Then, on July 3rd, he shouldered his backpack and began the 20-mile hike to the improved road. 2 days later, halfway there, he arrived in heavy rain at the beaver ponds that blocked access to the west bank of the Teklanika River. In April, they'd been frozen over and hadn't presented an obstacle. Now, he must have been alarmed to find a 3-acre lake covering the trail. To avoid having to wade through the murky, chest-deep water, he scrambled up a steep hillside, bypassed the ponds on the north, and then dropped back down to the river at the mouth of the gorge. When he'd first crossed the river 67 days earlier in the freezing temperatures of April, it had been an icy but gentle knee-deep creek, and he'd simply strolled across it. On July 5th, however, the Teklanika was at full flood, swollen with rain and snowmelt from glaciers high in the Alaska Range, running cold and fast. If he could reach the far shore, the remainder of the hike to the highway would be easy, but to get there, he would have to negotiate a channel some 100 feet wide. The water, opaque with glacial sediment and only a few degrees warmer than the ice it had so recently been, was the color of wet concrete. Too deep to wade, it rumbled like a freight train. The powerful current would quickly knock him off his feet and carry him away. McCandless was a weak swimmer, and had confessed to several people that he was in fact afraid of the water. Attempting to swim the numbingly cold torrent, or even to paddle some sort of improvised raft across, seemed too risky to consider. Just downstream from where the trail met the river, the Teklanika erupted into a chaos of boiling white water as it accelerated through the narrow gorge. Long before he could swim or paddle to the far shore, he'd be pulled into these rapids and drowned. In his journal he now wrote, "Disaster, rained in, river look impossible, lonely, scared." He concluded correctly that he would probably be swept to his death if he attempted to cross the Teklanika at that place in those conditions. It would be suicidal. It was simply not an option. If McCandless had walked a mile or so upstream, he would have discovered that the river broadened into a maze of braided channels. If he'd scouted carefully, by trial and error, he might have found a place where these braids were only chest deep. As strong as the current was running, it would have certainly knocked him off his feet, but by dog paddling and hopping along the bottom as he drifted downstream, he could conceivably have made it across before being carried into the gorge or succumbing to hypothermia. But it would still have been a very risky proposition. And at that point, McCandless had no reason to take such a risk. He'd been fending for himself quite nicely in the country. He probably understood that if he was patient and waited, the river would eventually drop to a level where it could be safely forded. After weighing his options, therefore, he settled on the most prudent course. He turned around and began walking to the west, back toward the bus, back into the fickle heart of the bush. Chapter 17. The Stampede Trail. Nature was here something savage and awful, though beautiful. I looked with awe at the ground I trod on, to see what the powers had made there, the form and fashion and material of their work. This was that earth of which we have heard, made out of chaos and old night. Here was no man's garden, but the unhandseled globe. It was not lawn, nor pasture, nor mead, nor woodland, nor lea, nor arable, nor wasteland. It was the fresh and natural surface of the planet Earth, as it was made forever and ever, to be the dwelling of man, we say. So nature made it, and man may use it if he can. Man was not to be associated with it. It was matter, vast, terrific, not his Mother Earth that we have heard of, not for him to tread on or to be buried in. No, it were being too familiar even to let his bones lie there. The home, this, of necessity and fate. There was clearly felt the presence of a force not bound to be kind to man. It was a place of heathenism and superstitious rites, to be inhabited by men nearer of kin to the rocks and to wild animals than we. What it is to be admitted to a museum, to see a myriad of particular things, compared with being shown some star's surface, some hard matter in its home. I stand in awe of my body. This matter to which I am bound has become so strange to me. I fear not spirits, ghosts, of which I am one. That my body might, but I fear bodies. I tremble to meet them. What is this Titan that has possession of me? Talk of mysteries. Think of our life in nature. Daily to be shown matter, to come in contact with it. Rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world, the common sense. Contact, contact. Who are we? Where are we? Henry David Thoreau, Katahdin. A year and a week after Chris McCandless decided not to attempt to cross the Teklanika River, I stand on the opposite bank, the eastern side, the highway side, and gaze into the churning water.